ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this January 29th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks to John Foran about corporate greenwashing and what must and can be done to save the planet. John Foran is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Fran Michel discusses the history of women cinematographers and the first ever nomination of a woman for Best Cinematography Oscar, Rachel Morrison. She's the director of photography for Mudbound. I will be talking with Laurie Mercier about two films, Mudbound and Strong Island. Both films are available on Netflix. Mudbound and Strong Island are both also nominated for Academy Awards, and they deal with race and other issues surrounding the questions about the murder of black men in America. Mudbound is a feature film, and Strong Island is a documentary. Book mole Larry Bolden reviews Bryce Courtney's novel, The Power of One. And that will wrap up our show for the morning. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we turn to Bill Resnick and John Foran.
Thank you, Denise. John Foran, welcome to KBOO again.
Thanks so much, Bill.
John Foran again teaches at UC Santa Barbara. His specialties are climate crisis, global climate justice movements, sustainable development, building better futures. John is also a co-founder of the organization System Change, Not Climate Change, and he publishes a good deal on its website, and even more on the website Resilience. 2 weeks ago, we talked to John on the severity of climate change, particularly in the Global South, now in the Global South, coming to you soon in much more severe ways, and also how temperatures are rising fast if that continues, and there's really a good chance of human extinction. Today, we'll be discussing the most interesting response, or rather non-response, to climate change by corporate America and also the U.S. military. What a fascinating story they are. Now nearly all Republicans are committed to the view that humans did not cause climate change and is really not likely to develop into a problem. But what's interesting is that corporate America, and in fact the U.S. military, don't share that view. They are taking climate change very seriously. They accept the message of climate scientists and they are acting. But, of course, not in ways that could save the planet. In the second part of this interview, we'll discuss what must be done and what they are not doing. But first, we'll discuss what corporations and the U.S. military are doing, why, and why it's so inadequate. John, tell us the story first. Maybe we can begin with Exxon. It's so stark.
Okay, sure. Well, Exxon is well-known now because it's being taken to court by the state of New York. The Attorney General of New York has taken Exxon and other major oil companies to court for basically knowing about climate change, their own climate scientists telling them this way back in the 70s, and being quite clear that climate change is real, the corporation then making sure that that news stayed inside the corporation. And looking at it now, it's sort of criminally reckless to have done that, and that's the basis of the lawsuit. And there are other kinds of interesting lawsuits directed at corporations in general and in particular for causing some of the severe impacts that we're seeing, for example, erosion of shore up in Alaska where people live, young people have suits against major corporations for destroying their future, both in the United States and in the Netherlands. And so the courts are being used in interesting ways, starting to be used in interesting ways to take on the corporations, which are bent by their own logic to make short-term profit for their shareholders at all costs.
Yeah, one of the ways, of course, and they're sort of prudent men in a weird way, only with regard to their assets and their, in a very, very narrow way, that with regard to their assets, the company's assets, and their salaries. Exxon and I think Shell have not just, they haven't just recognized climate change, they've acted upon it to protect and they want to protect their assets. They've raised the height of their oil platforms, right, in various places to make sure that in a huge storm, their big assets, and those oil platforms can be $500 million, $1 billion apiece, that they're not going to be swamped in a huge storm. They know climate change is happening, and they are really acting.
That is true, and it's almost humorous to watch it if it wasn't so tragic. I think it shows that there are different kinds of rationality, and that humans have certain capabilities to be reasonable under certain very limited parameters, and we're less good at being rational in thinking really about the consequences down the road of everything that we do. And I think that sort of split accounts for how they get away with it, because they're banking also literally on the fact that the rest of us are also so involved in our lives and trying to, you know, make life as survivable and joyful as possible here in Trump's America, that we're not able to devote either a lot of our thinking or a lot of our time to activism against them. But I think they're mistaken.
Yeah, tell us, there are other, it seems to me most of corporate America in one way or another is in fact trying to protect themselves and protect their industry. There's also, I think the really interesting, one of the most interesting and important struggles is being waged by the investor-owned utilities like PGE and Pacific Power and Duke Energy and on and on and on, and their financiers, who have a huge stake in saving the investor-owned utilities. After all, they financed it all. They want to minimize and destroy small-scale energy developments or city, local, municipal energy and public energy. What are they doing now to protect their... They want to protect their monopoly and protect their profits. Tell us that story.
Well, that's right. And here in California is a particularly good place to size up the sort of state of that struggle between the utilities, again, largely fossil fuel, overwhelmingly fossil fuel producing energy entities, and communities, which, like all the polls show, most Americans want renewable energy. Most Americans think climate change is a real danger. And so there's a movement now, energy democracy or community choice, around this question that communities might be able to circumvent the utilities if they don't switch to renewables and go ahead and try and make other arrangements. And of course, utilities don't like renewable energy, particularly solar and wind, because they are decentralized. They are suitable for communities. They can work on a smaller scale without an enormous investment in a grid that is required for fossil fuels. And so that's the battle being fought out. And again, that's being fought politically and legally, and we're kind of watching that to see what happens. But of course, the utilities are in a position to fight that battle. And of course, also in the current political atmosphere, increasingly the law and regulations are being sort of loosened up in their favor. And again, that's a very important battle and a very important struggle to watch. And you can think of it as the utilities, the banks, and the corporations are kind of a triumvirate that basically the elephant in the room, of course, is the whole global capitalist economy. And What we're talking about ultimately is whether capitalism can get us through, muddle through this crisis, or whether we're really going to have to think well beyond capitalism if we hope to come out at the other end of it in one piece.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit, remind people, I sometimes watch sports events. I hate myself for doing it, but it's an addiction I acquired very early in life. But I watch these sports events some and then turn them off, thank God, quickly. But Chevron has been doing a huge amount of advertising, calling attention to its experiments that we are a green company and we are working on alternative energy. What do you make of that? Not only BP did, some of the other oil companies did it early and then they quit because they just weren't any good at alternative energy.
Oh, that's right. I mean, that goes in the category of laughable as well. The problem, of course, is these are commercial spots on television with audiences, and we're being bombarded by conflicting messages, and that's all they have to do. They know that all they have to do is create enough uncertainty in people's minds or enough of a kind of good time feeling associating their products with the sports that we are addicted to and enjoy watching, and they can get away with it, so they think. And the classic case, as you started to allude to, is BP Oil in the UK, which back in the early 2000s said stood for Beyond Petroleum.
Yes.
And, you know, the word for all of this is greenwashing, and it's a well-known corporate strategy, and it's, you know, trying to take the green that is the right thing to do in terms of the environment and factoring in all of the ecological costs of how we live. And then just twisting it in their direction because they have the means to do that.
Yeah, of course, greenwashing is, you know, one form of hypocrisy. But then there's that old saw that hypocrisy is vice's tribute to virtue. Well, they're in fact, in those ads, it's a double-edged sword because they're sort of acknowledging that we have a problem. But I guess for each of these individual companies, that's okay.
They are. That's right. And, that's a sign of the times. At a certain point, the reality, the physical reality of climate change, it's unavoidable. You can't help but see it. It becomes much more than the elephant in the room. It starts to crush us. And we talked about that last time in the extreme weather that now here in the United States, even wealthy communities are subject to. So those are the sort of what they have to. That's the ultimate limit against which, as Bill McKibben likes to say, you can't compromise with the laws of physics or with nature in that sense. And you know, that's why they sort of haltingly talk about this and why the military takes it seriously in their planning and so forth. But their fatal flaw or limitation is that they can't think beyond the present economic and political arrangements, and so they're left with half measures that simply won't do.
Yeah, we should call people's attention to the military. It's a quite fat U.S. military. It's a very fascinating story. We won't be able to really get into it. Let me do a station ID, and then we can spend a couple minutes on the military before we get into what should be done the huge risks they're taking in there. In any event, this is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to John Foran, who's a scholar activist. He writes a lot. He's also very active in building movements in California, movements really that are threatening some of the big corporate apparatus, but they're fighting back. It's a really interesting story. John, let's just call attention to what the military is doing. It's fun to realize it, although it's, of course, horrible in its impact.
Well, the U.S. military, the first shocking fact is how much of our budget is devoted to it and how much the United States spends on its military, and basically we spend more than our next 10 competitors combined. So we should have the number one military in the world with all of that, and we do. But with that comes the fact that the military is also the number one consumer of fossil fuels as an entity anywhere in the world, and thus sort of the one of the prime reasons that we have a climate crisis. And taking those two facts together, you know, the writing is on the wall. It would be a very simple and smart but very radical and almost unthinkable thing to do is to severely cut the military budget and to use those resources, to direct those resources to things that we really need to cope with this crisis, whether that be education, whether that be healthcare, or whether that be sort of direct subsidizing of the transition to fossil fuel, to renewable energy, because let's not forget that fossil fuels not only have all the money on their side, they also have incredible subsidies that, and tax breaks and regulatory breaks that make it that much harder to switch to renewable, which in a fair fight would be an easy and obvious thing to do.
Yeah, let me. I did a little studying of the military last night and climate change. It's the Trump administration, as we well know, is thinks climate change is a hoax and it's going to go away. The military has a different idea. They're extremely worried about climate change. So a number of recent things come out of Congress reports, legislative changes. One of them, of course, is the military appropriations budget that the Trump administration looked at, and they cut out all expenditures for climate change. On the other hand, there's their policy report, which Congress has approved, which calls for added monies and effort to combat climate change and to deal with the national security implications of climate change. And anyway, we won't go on. There's so many just hilarious quotes from military, including James Mattis, who's now the Secretary of Defense, about the problems of climate change and and how it's going to affect U.S. national security. And they're also, of course, they talk about the immense costs of shipping barrels of oil to our advanced bases all over the world. And wouldn't it be so much better if we had solar-powered mobility machines so that our guerrilla forces that are fighting in maybe 50 countries right now, one way or another, the special forces, if they could move completely silently, because internal combustion engines make noise, and they would like to be silent. And they are also making vehicles to do that, and they're developing installations. They're spending a lot of money on, in fact, solar power, solar electricity. But, of course, for their purposes of killing lots of other people. John, let's now... It seems to me both the military and our we don't have too much time. The military and our business elite, the whole apparatus, has decided to take the risk of climate change extinguishing all of us in order to maintain themselves, and they're becoming more and more committed to the idea that they've decided that geoengineering can solve all of our problems. We can deal with carbon in the air by somehow extracting it, and many other things. That technology will save us. Tell us that story.
Well, that's another sort of ploy that is, because of our inaction on climate change and because of the success of capital, politically and economically, we're being taken right over the livable thresholds of greenhouse gases and thus ultimately global warming. And we're told we can relax because of some future has yet to be perfected technology of one kind or another will allow us to actually decarbonize and make up for the devastating errors that we're making at the moment somewhere down the road. And it's, you know, the logic of that is actually being forced on us almost as a fait accompli because of inaction and more inaction and the slow pace at which the world is waking up to the crisis. So geoengineering has to now actually, I find serious thinkers and activists, you know, have to take it seriously, not just because it's a smokescreen, but because in fact we are going to probably have to do that. But to use that as an excuse to continue with reckless expansion of dirty energy is the exact wrong message to take away from the necessity to do that. It simply means that we have to make that transition as quickly as possible because we're relying on uninvented technology at this point.
And that some of it could also have disastrous feedback loops, right? That's another story, though, the enormous risks of geoengineering, and yet they're making it necessary, as John Ferran just said. John, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure, Bill.
Right.
Always.
Right. So long.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. I'm your host, Denise Morris. This morning, I'm here with Patricia Kohlberg, our engineer. That was the Dead Weather, Die by the Drop that we heard, music transition there. And thanks to Bill Resnick and John Foran for their piece on climate change. Coming up later in the program, I will be reviewing two films with Laurie Mercier, Mudbound and Strong Island, both very important films for folks to consider and watch and available on Netflix. We'll talk about those, and our book mole, Larry Bolden, will review Bryce Courtney's novel, The Power of One. But next, we have Fran Michel discussing the history of women cinematographers and the first ever nomination of a woman for a Best Cinematography Oscar, Rachel Morrison, director of photography for Mudbound.
Nominations for the 2018 Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Awards, the Oscars, mark the first time a woman has been nominated for her work in the Best Cinematography category. As we've noted on the Old Mole Variety Hour, there are reasons to be skeptical about the Oscars, starting from their origins in the late 1920s as part of producer Louis B. Mayer's attempt to prevent unionization in the motion picture industry, and continuing through the Oscars So White hashtag campaign of 2016. That campaign helped foreground the excessively old, male, and white membership of the Academy, and prompted the admission of the most diverse group of new members ever added to the voting roster. Still, precisely because the Oscars have tended to reward upper-middle-brow mainstream success, they can yield significant professional rewards for those recognized. That's why, as Pamela Hutchinson notes in The Guardian, quote, Rachel Morrison's Academy Award nomination in the Best Cinematography category is a landmark for women in film. This shortlist has long been the toughest Oscar ceiling to crack, but now, for the first time since the awards began in 1929, a woman has been included. Morrison, who shot the overcast landscapes and intimate interiors of 1940s drama Mudbound for director Dee Reese, stands a good chance of winning, but women in her field may be forgiven for celebrating already, end quote. Hutchinson points out that even though women have always worked as camera operators, they have also always been seen as anomalies for doing so. Quote, at the turn of the 20th century in Brighton, England, Laura Bailey operated the camera for her husband George Albert Smith. Georgette Méliès turned the handle in her father George's studio in Paris in the early 1900s, end quote. Hutchinson discusses several other women working as camera operators in the silent era, mentioning Rosina Cianelli, Grace Davidson, Francella Billington, Marjorie Ordway, Dorothy Dunn, and Louise Lowell. We might lengthen that list of women cinematographers of the silent era by looking to the Women Film Pioneers Project, where we can also find out about Mary Marvin Breckinridge, Mae Clark, Dorothea Mitchell, Adriana Ehlers, and Dolores Ehlers. Women's involvement in shooting films didn't end with the coming of sound, and Hutchinson mentions the notable work of several currently successful female directors of photography who've been working steadily since the 1970s or 80s. Carolyn Charpentier's credits include the features Holy Motors and Hannah Arendt. Sandy Sissel has worked on all kinds of films, but perhaps most notably on documentaries, including Before Stonewall and Free Angela and All Political Prisoners. Agnès Godard has often worked with director Claire Denis on films including Beau Travail and 35 Shots of Rum. Nina Kellgren has worked often with Isaac Julian. Among other films, she shot Looking for Langston, Young Soul Rebels, and Frantz Fanon, Black Skin, White Mask. And Ellen Curris is well known for her work with Spike Lee and Michel Gondry. Hutchinson also notes that women have been directors of photography on such recent critical successes as The Leveling, shot by Nano Siegel, Hidden Figures, shot by Mandy Walker, The Neon Demon, shot by Natasha Breyer, and Fences and Molly's Game, both shot by Charlotte Bruce Christensen. Despite this long record, women cinematographers have had, Hutchinson suggests, a particularly difficult time gaining recognition and have faced perhaps more opposition than women in other fields of filmmaking. The American Society of Cinematographers, ASC, was founded in 1919 but didn't invite a woman to join until 1980, when it admitted Brianne Murphy, reportedly the first woman to work as a cinematographer on a major Hollywood studio film. As of 2015, Deadline reported that just 4% of the ASC's members were women. And in 2017, the Society gave its President's Award to a woman for the very first time. The recipient was Nancy Schreiber, the fourth woman to join the ASC in 1995. Hutchinson doesn't venture an explanation for this, but she does point out that camera operator is one of the few jobs on a film set to be stuck with a gendered title. Cameraman has persisted for a long time, just as long as script girl and best boy. Hutchinson's helpful description of the work of the cinematographer may provide some illumination. Quote, "The cinematographer or director of photography, DP, is the director's right hand on set. It's a demanding job, combining artistry, advanced technical knowledge, and team management. As the DP selects the camera, lens, and lighting for each shot, and commands a crew of electricians and camera operators. A good cinematographer works closely with the director to achieve the desired visual effect in each scene. A great one imparts their own unique vision to the film." Evocatively, cinematographer John Alton described the trade in the title of his 1949 book as "Painting with Light." End quote. We might guess that the assumptions about the gender of the cinematographer might be related to gendered assumptions about exercising advanced technical knowledge and commanding a crew of other technicians. Jane Gaines and Michelle Kerner, in their essay on women camera operators at the Women Film Pioneer Project, describe profiles of women camera operators in the silent era in which the woman is always presented as a novelty. Quote, "In her strange new relation to the technological device, this female aberration becomes a metaphor for the wondrous strangeness of motion picture photography itself." End quote. But Gaines and Kerner, like Hutchinson, also indicate that articles tend to dwell on the women's appearance. It's not unusual, even now, for journalists to devote more attention to appearance when describing a woman than a man, whether she's a performer or a politician, a scientist or a cinematographer. But the director of photography is the very opposite of the visual object. When Laura Mulvey inaugurated the field of feminist film theory with her 1975 essay on visual pleasure and narrative cinema, she characterized the Hollywood pattern as one in which man is bearer of the look, woman is object of the gaze. A few years earlier, John Berger and co-authors similarly described the long tradition of Western art history as one in which men act and women appear. I don't mean to suggest, of course, that those pithy formulations offer an adequate summary of those theories, nor that those theories provide a comprehensively nuanced and intersectional account of looking relations, nor that nothing has changed since the 1970s, much less since the silent era. But Berger and Mulvey do point to something deep and persistent in the gendering of the gaze. Hutchinson points to the work women cinematographers have done to challenge bias against them and to support each other. Nancy Schreiber, the fourth woman to join the American Society of Cinematographers and the first to win its President's Awards, is now part of ASC's Vision Committee an initiative to promote greater diversity in cinematography. In the U.S., female collective Cinematographers XX was founded as a way to make women in the field more visible. The names of experienced DPs are listed on a website with links to their work. In the UK, Illuminatrix works on the same principle. And there's also the International Collective of Female Cinematographers, who provide each other with community support and industry advocacy. There's no longer any excuse to argue that female cinematographers are hard to find. End quote. A woman cinematographer not only challenges expectations about women's technical expertise and leadership in directing a crew of electricians and camera operators, but also foregrounds women's positions as subjects rather than just objects of the gaze. Not all women are directors of photography, but every sighted woman is the subject of her own gaze. Greater recognition of the work of professional painters with light marks an advance not only for women as cinematographers, but also for women as cinema goers. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
Put your hand in the hand of a man who calmed the sea.
That is Donny Hathaway singing Put Your Hand in the Hand. I'm Denise Morris. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7, listener-supported radio. I'm here with Laurie Mercier. We're going to double dip this morning and try to tackle a couple of films that are both available on Netflix. One produced by Netflix, Mudbound, a feature film, and Strong Island, a documentary. Both are up for Academy Awards, as you just heard Fran Michel talking about cinematographer Rachel Morrison, and a number of other awards for both of these films. Coming up, the Academy Awards may not be the thing that people use to judge all films, but it's important to get those voices in those films some recognition, and we're going to try to talk a little bit about some of the underpinnings in both of them. Laurie, you've got a little bit to say about both films to get the ball rolling.
Yes, and I think, Denise, we both agree that these are two outstanding films that, as you said, are now streaming on Netflix, and they're about the haunting legacy of structural racism in the United States. Mudbound is a fictional account of two families in post-World War II Mississippi, and Strong Island is a documentary about the killing of filmmaker Yancey Ford's 24-year-old brother, William Jr., in Long Island in 1992. Both films explore the lives of white and black families trapped in the system of racial injustice, whether 1940s Mississippi or 1990s Long Island, and the generational trauma of what we might call ordinary racial violence. The films provide a micro view of the untold and countless ways in which white supremacy inhabits our culture and terrorizes black lives. Many listeners may have seen or heard of Mudbound, which has won many awards and, as you said, Denise, nominated for several Oscars, especially for Mary Blige in categories of supporting actor and best adapted screenplay by Virgil Williams and director Dee Reese. In Mudbound, two men, one white, Garrett Hedlund, one black, Jason Mitchell, return home to Mississippi from World War II as very changed individuals, but in a very unchanged rural South, where they struggle to navigate pernicious racism and adjust to life after war, and as fellow veterans develop an unlikely friendship. Now, filmmaker Dee Reese depicts how that relationship is burdened and deconstructs the white savior myth through the Garrett Hedlund character, who cannot save Jason Mitchell's Ronzel character. Although he is a good, if flawed, character, he too is victim to a larger social dynamic that no amount of individual kindness could hope to overturn. Strong Island has also won many awards, produced and directed by Yancey Ford, with Danny Glover and Laura Poitras among some of the executive producers. The film chronicles the history of the Ford family. And here, the Ford family appears as themselves, Barbara Dunmore, the mother, William Ford, and their three children, following them from the racial segregation of the Jim Crow South to the promise of New York City, from the presumed safety of their Long Island middle-class suburb to the unexpected violent death of the oldest son, William Ford Jr. The film has several aims. It investigates the murder of Ford's brother in April 1992, which was 2 weeks before the Rodney King verdict. William Ford Jr. was a 24-year-old teacher who was trying to become a police officer and was killed by Mark Riley, a white 19-year-old mechanic. Although Ford was unarmed, he became the prime suspect in his own murder, and his murderer was never tried. The film seeks to account for the impacts on his family over those decades and to piece together who he really was rather than who and what society made him out to be. Strong Island asks what one can do when the grief of loss is entwined with historical injustice. So, Denise, maybe we could talk about Mudbound first. And you and I, when we initially saw this film, were a bit critical of how the white characters seem to dominate and how the white family seemed to have more character development than the black family. But I think we've come to reconsider that initial assessment.
Right, and I have to admit to being a distracted movie watcher when I'm at home. I do better in a theater where I have no distractions. So I watched the film several times, and I think there are a lot of reviewers out there that miss the nuances in this film as well, or miss the way that the film kind of uses all of its ammunition, so to speak, to tell a very deep story with subtlety, leading to obviously the climax in the film. And so as I went on kind of my own little journey to unpack it for myself and began to understand that in some simple ways, not to conflate that with simplistic, but just with the ease of how the film moves forward, there's a lot that gets revealed. And in a 2 hour and 15 minute span of time, you can only do so much. However, one of the things that came up often was the use of multiple voices. So there are essentially six points of view. And the film being made from a book written by a white woman, she was apparently counseled by her friends not to try to write black characters, and had to come to the conclusion that if she were to write this story and not give voice to those characters, that's not the way she wanted to go. So she endeavored to write these characters, and it meant that she didn't have one central voice, one overall narrator, but multiple voices. So that's where I think a lot of the texture comes from in the film. So you hear this kind of internal dialogue, these monologues, voiceover style monologues, that really set the landscape of how, not just how people see themselves or the characters see themselves in the world, but how the relationships kind of piece together a sensibility about what those structural issues were, how those relationships between whites and blacks in the South were complex and contradictory and could lead to reconciliation or violence at any point.
And Dee Reese, the filmmaker, really shows us in very immediate ways how the black family members are at the mercy of the white family next door, the tenant farmers, the McAllens, who own the farm on which they are tenant farmers. And how this labor, what many people, including Dee Reese, refers to as the emotional labor that black people must provide to white people in the United States, and how on a daily basis that emotional labor takes a toll. And we can think of just so many scenes, the Mary Blige character who is obligated to leave her own family and her husband who has a broken leg to go care for the children of the McGowan white family. And repeatedly, one sees how, as sympathetic as these white family members might be, they have no clue about what their demands are doing to the members of this black family.
And they bring her into a situation where there's actual potential for violence and danger, given the pappy character, the father character, is the vigilant racist in the film and represents that racism versus the what we might call the everyday occurrences that that govern people's lives about where you can be, where you can go, what you can have, what you can do, and what you can't. So bringing her into their home with a person like that didn't seem to ever occur to them at that point that he could be actually violent towards her and put her in a position of having to be humiliated or harmed.
Or the fact that the character Jamie, or the Garrett Hedlund character, reaches out to Jason Mitchell, who's the black veteran. And of course, we know historically that black veterans returning to their communities, whether in Beaumont, Texas, or Detroit, Michigan, their very presence as veterans ignite all kinds of rage and opposition, and this is clearly happening in this Mississippi town. But the Garrett Hedlund character, by reaching out to Jason Mitchell, really endangers Jason Mitchell's life.
Yeah, and that is really, I think that's well drawn, and it's very, you know, the film doesn't spend a lot of time with a lot of dialogue, long conversations. You know, it does very kind of, even though the pacing is slow, it kind of has to quickly move through these encounters in a way. But those moments between the two of them, I think, exhibit the kind of danger and the ignorance on the part of Jamie to Ronzell's potential danger in just being with him and accepting a ride home.
Right, right.
And being in his presence, and here they are, veterans who both are experiencing the aftermath of, you know, loss and war and all of those things. Their connection isn't allowed to flourish even on that level.
Because, and even that apocalyptic event, World War II, does not shake up the racial structure of
exactly.
the United States.
Yeah. Well, liberators, as he says, I was a liberator over there. Back here, I'm just, you know.
A prisoner.
Yeah, essentially.
Well, what about Strong Island, a very different film, a documentary, and, of course, a half century later, but in many ways dealing with the same kind of racist superstructure that really limits the lives of this particular black family, the Ford family. And so what about Yancey Ford's approach to this topic?
Well, that is probably the one thing that many reviewers have talked about as much as the content of the film is his approach to the documentary. There's a lot of use of family photos. There's some footage, beautiful footage of, you know, landscape, but never the footage of landscape is often altered in some way. So you might see a sprinkler moving back and forth, but has been altered, you know, cinematically to look not exactly like that. So nothing looks exactly like it could. Images of subway, images on the streets. The film is mostly constructed of photos and interviews. And one of the devices that Yancey uses is that extreme close-up, where as a viewer, you cannot escape the image of his face in speaking about the issues and about his own relationship to that event. And of course, these incredibly deep contributions from his mother as well about what happened. I mean,
she is an amazing narrator, Barbara Dunmore, the mother, very powerful, as is Yancey Ford's in close-up views of the pain that she's experiencing, and really forcing American viewers to come to terms with the emotional trauma of racism in America.
Mm-hmm.
And the film carries that out very beautifully and powerfully, and I'm still haunted by the film. So we obviously recommend both of the films,
right.
Mudbound and Strong Island.
Right.
And what do they say about racism in the United States?
Right, exactly. And I wanted to just close real quick with something from Dee Rees. Unless you investigate what you inherit in terms of ideas, attitudes and thoughts about the world, how can you be mindful about what you're passing on? And that's Dee Rees. This is Denise Morris with Laurie Mercier talking about Mudbound and Strong Island. That is Lead Me Home by Jamie Commons. I'm Denise Morris. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer this morning, and I'm here with Larry Bolden, who is going to review Bryce Courtney's novel, The Power of One. Larry?
Good morning. I want to talk to you today about a wonderful and inspiring book by Bryce Courtney, The Power of One. I was moved by this book in a profound and lasting way. I'm so thankful to my reader friends who continue to alert me to wonderful books that have somehow passed me by. The book is set in South Africa, and its hero, or should I say one of its heroes, is a 5-year-old boy who names himself PK. He's the youngest boy in a primarily Afrikaner boarding school, and he is persecuted and terrified by the Afrikaner, that is, Boer students, who call him a ruinic, meaning English, and hate him for it. His main persecutor is a big, older boy, Mevro. Quote, ahead of me lay the dreaded Mevro, the judge and the jury, and the beginning of the power of one. How I learned that in each of us there burns a flame of independence that must never be allowed to go out, that as long as it exists within us, we cannot be destroyed. Close quote. The first 50 pages of the book were so sad, the bullying so oppressive, that I considered giving up on it, but I'm so glad I didn't. Mevro is a huge fan of Hitler, and he taunts PK constantly with the threat that when Hitler comes to South Africa, he will march all of the Ruinuiks into the sea. Although incredibly precocious in some ways, PK is almost totally naive in others. He has no map of the world in his mind and is so naive regarding the larger world that under the assault from Mevro, he actually thinks that South Africa is on the side of the Germans in World War II. His only companion and defender in the early part of the book is a wise and gnarly old chicken, Grandpa Chuck, whom his nanny has helped him smuggle into the boarding school. Eventually, Mevro and his gang of bullies declare both PK and Grandpa Chuck prisoners of war and regularly haze them in horrible ways behind the outhouse, eventually killing Grandpa Chuck. Finally, PK gets some respite from Mevro when a semester ends and he is sent to his grandfather in a small town. The grandfather, who had a small farm until a chicken disease wiped out all of his chickens, is one of the few bright lights in PK's early life. On the train journey, PK runs into the first of a string of saviors, a railroad worker who cares for him in his long train trip and who insists that someday PK will be the welterweight champion of the world. quoting from the book, "I didn't know then what seemed like the end was only the beginning. All children are flotsam, driven by the ebb and flow of adult lives. Unbeknown to me, the tide had turned and I was being swept out to sea." Close quote. It is the railroad worker, Hoppy, himself a locally famous boxer, who teaches PK, quote, "First with the head and then with the heart. That's how a man stays ahead from the start." PK says, "He gave me a defense system, and with it he gave me hope." I don't want to tell you too much of the story, since Courtney lets it flow out for the reader in such a lovely and fascinating way. But I will say that after meeting and being cared for by Hoppy, the next savior for PK is a professor of music who has exiled himself to South Africa and spends most of his waking hours gathering succulents and cactus for his superb succulent garden. Doc, as PK comes to call him, contrives for PK to take piano lessons from him in spite of the objections of PK's born-again Christian mother, who is suspicious of all who do not share her born-again faith. Doc is drawn to PK not so much because of his musical promise, but because he has such an inquisitive mind and is so eager to learn. In my 50-plus years of teaching, I came to believe strongly, as Doc does, that openness and curiosity are the most important aspects of a good learner and of intelligence. Doc takes PK into the hills every day to catalog and gather specimens, and he teaches him to look carefully at everything and so see everything as interconnected. But while Doc has a wonderful and orderly mind, he also instills in PK a deep reverence for nature and for the mystery that lies therein. Quote, "The vines are people you encounter who are afraid of originality. When you're a young plant, they are very dangerous. Always listen to yourself, PK. It is better to be wrong than simply to follow convention. If you are wrong, no matter, you have learned something, and you will grow stronger. If you are right, you have taken another step towards a fulfilling life." Close quote. Doc teaches him to really look and to think clearly, but he continues, quoting from the book again, "In this world, there are very few things made from logic alone. It is illogical for a man to be too logical. Some things we must just let stand. The mystery is more important than any possible explanation. The searcher after truth must search with humanity." I'm wondering if that word should be humility. "Ruthless logic is the sign of a limited mind. The truth can only add to the sum of what you know, while a harmless mystery left unexplored often adds to the meaning of life. When a truth is not so important, it is better left as a mystery." Close quote. When World War II expands to South Africa, Doc is arrested and imprisoned, essentially simply for being a German. Fortunately, the commandant of the prison is a lover of music and feels privileged to have Doc in his prison, even arranging for him to have his Steinway transported to the prison in exchange for a concert to impress his superiors and the townspeople. BK is allowed access to the prison on a daily basis and continues to learn from Doc. Also, despite his youth and his small size, he is allowed into the boxing program at the prison, where yet another of his heroes, a black man, Giel Piet, comes into play. Giel Piet teaches him how to box and how to use his feet to stay out of the way of the much bigger sluggers, fighters, who can hit hard but can't really box. Quote, "The boxer who takes chances gets hit and gets hurt. Box, never fight. Fighting is for heavyweights and domkops." Giel Piet and the way he is treated by Afrikaners also brings BK to understand that, quote, "Racism is a primary force of evil designed to destroy good men." I think there will be some readers who will simply not be able to accept the precocity of this young boy, will not be able to achieve that suspension of disbelief that is required to lose oneself in a well-told story. Courtney himself seems to anticipate this when he has PK say, quote, "You may ask how a six-year-old could think like this. I can only answer that one did." Close quote. For my part, I was happily and wholly in the thrall of this wonderful book. There are so many side stories in it that I haven't time to touch on. I recommend it to you with all my heart. It has enriched my life, and I think it will enrich yours. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. And this is Denise Morris, your host for this morning's Old Mole, and Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer. I want to tell you what's coming up on KBOO this morning at 10 o'clock on Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein talks to investigative reporter Adam Fetterman about his series on the Department of the Interior under the Trump administration. At 11 on On the Ground Radio looks at the economics of immigration politics, voices of the Women's March, and news from South Africa and Israel. That's all coming up this morning on the KBOO. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Well, it takes a village or a labor to put on the Old Mall every Monday morning. So I want to thank all of our guests. John Foran and Bill Resnick is our Old Mall at the top of the hour, as always. Larry Bolden for all of his great work with book reviews. Laurie Mercier, who returns to the Old Mall doing some movie reviews this morning. And, of course, our engineer, Patricia Kohlberg. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.
KBOO Portland.
February 13, 1983, KBOO Community Radio held an open house to celebrate moving into a building that we could come to own here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Join us Tuesday, February 13th for the 35th anniversary of the open house moving-in party. Food, drinks, tours, and memories will be on hand as we celebrate 35 years in this building and 50 years of KBOO. That's the 35th anniversary open house, Tuesday, February 13th, 5 to 8 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Imago Theater's production of Shakespeare's The Rape of Lucrece. The play runs from January 25th through February 8th at the Imago Theater in Portland. The chamber art musical, The Rape of Lucrece, is an intense, intimate production featuring a combination of spoken word and song. This show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Shakespeare's The Rape of Lucrece. The play runs from January 25th through February 8th at the Imago Theater, 17 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Last week, the bulk of the National Park Service Advisory Board resigned en masse in condemnation of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's